Texas is one step closer to banning sanctuary cities. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. The Texas Senate this week quickly approved legislation to ban sanctuary cities. Senate Bill 4 would gut funding to local governments that don't cooperate with immigration officials. But as Texas Public Radio's Ryan Poppy reports, the bill will likely move more slowly through the Texas House, where representatives have their own sanctuary city proposals.
Debate on Lubbock Republican Charles Berry's bill was heated, ending with a vote along party lines, with 20 Senate Republicans voting for the bill, 10 Democrats, like San Antonio Senator Carlos Uresti, voting against it. The bill denies state grant money to jurisdictions where police refuse federal requests to hand over immigrants already in custody for possible deportation. An amendment added to the bill Tuesday would allow the state to remove a county sheriff from office for refusing to honor federal detention requests. Senator Carlos Uresti of San Antonio said the bill is unconstitutional.
What's at stake here is a discriminatory effect, the discriminatory effect that it's going to have on many individuals in my district and in the state of Texas.
Uresti and other Senate Democrats claimed the bill would make Hispanics targets of racial profiling during traffic stops and when being booked into jail. Perry says his bill simply seeks to require cooperation with federal immigration officials.
What's at stake here is the rule of law. What's at stake here is inconsistently applying laws across this country as well as this state. People believe that laws are applied differently to different groups for different reasons based on the elected official of the day.
The legislation may not get a big welcome from the Texas House. Some Republican representatives there have concerns. Lyle Larson of San Antonio wants to make sure that local police officers could use their own discretion in deciding when to ask about a person's immigration status.
There have been times when I'm riding with police officers, they do have discretion on what they enforce, and they look at their time on the beat, and if they arrest somebody for a petty crime, it takes them 2 hours out of service in an area.
Representative Charlie Guerin, a Republican from Tarrant County, has his own sanctuary cities bill and says there's no rush in the House to adopt the Senate version.
We've got House bills to hear before Senate bills, and the Senate bills, you know, they're going to have some bills over here this week, I understand. That doesn't make them go to the top of the list for that, and we'll get to the Senate bills when it's time to get to them.
The Senate moved quickly to adopt the sanctuary cities ban after Governor Greg Abbott designated it an emergency item. It's unlikely action will be taken as quickly on the other side of the Capitol. Ryan Poppy, Texas Public Radio News.
In Travis County, commissioners are figuring out how to replace $1.5 million in grant money cut by Governor Greg Abbott. The governor acted after Sheriff Sally Hernandez announced a policy limiting her cooperation with the federal immigration agency known as ICE. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey reports while private donations are starting to come in, it's not nearly enough to fill the budget gap.
Travis Gatlin is searching for something.
Sorry, I wasn't expecting this. I gotta find.
Gatlin is the Travis County Budget Director. He's looking for notification he and the county got back in December that eligibility requirements for criminal justice grants awarded through the governor's office had changed.
Okay, yeah, so what it says is there is an option to not include this certification, but with the understanding that the authorized official submitting...
What Gatlin's reading off is a new requirement that jurisdictions applying for these grants certify that their local sheriff complies with ICE requests to detain undocumented immigrants booked in the jail. Travis County does only in the case of high-level felonies. So would Travis County apply again for the recently cut-off grant? Gatlin says, despite all that's gone on in the last month...
The plan for now is that we would submit applications.
My current thinking is that there is great utility in going ahead and continuing to apply.
Travis County Judge Sarah Eckhart says the county will most likely still apply for the grants, even though the governor's office says that, quote, may result in the denial of applications. With that denial looming, the county will consider alternate funding, too. Eckhart says one option is foundation money. Another, possibly raising taxes.
That is always a possibility. I want to be very mindful about a tax increase to cover this shortfall, but that may be what we will have to look to.
At their meeting, Travis County commissioners will begin discussing ways to fund these programs long term and through the remainder of what would have been the grant period. For Fronteras, I'm Audrey McGlinchey.
When Donald Trump was running for president, he pledged to reduce immigration, both illegal and legal. His allies in Congress hope to make good on that promise. NPR's John Burnett reports on new legislation targeting legal immigration.
The landmark Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965 opened the nation's borders to people from parts of the world who'd previously been excluded from becoming Americans. Today, a new generation of immigration restrictionists thinks it's time to reduce those numbers. The junior senators from Arkansas and Georgia, Tom Cotton and David Perdue, are proposing a new law. Here is Tom Cotton.
The goal here is to get our immigration levels back to historical norms, to take something of a pause to allow the economy to catch up with the immigrants that we have allowed into our country over the last two generations, and to focus on the well-being of American citizens, those citizens who are here today, many of whom are struggling economically.
Their bill would do three things. First, limit the number of foreign nationals who are able to get green cards to reunite with their families already in the U.S. This is currently the largest category of legal immigrants. Second, cut the number of refugees in half. And third, eliminate the diversity visa lottery, a program that gives visas to countries with low rates of immigration to the U.S. The United States has the most generous immigration policy in the world, and Tom Cotton says the number of green cards awarded, about a million each year, is excessive.
So in 1 year, this would reduce it to around 600,000, and over the span of the 10-year window, it would fall to about 500,000.
A plan to cut immigration in half faces entrenched opposition among immigration-friendly Republicans, pro-immigrant Democrats, and the business lobby that favors high immigration rates. But the proposed law has friends in high places. Cotton says he's been coordinating with the Trump administration and its coterie of longtime anti-immigration figures. Among them, the president's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, Attorney General nominee, Senator Jeff Sessions, and Julie Kirchner. She was executive director of the far-right immigration restrictionist group, Federation for American Immigration Reform. Now she's a special political advisor in U.S. Customs and Border Protection.
I've been around this issue for 35 years, and what I'm seeing is that the voices who are in favor of restricting immigration are on the ascendancy.
Linda Chavez is a conservative political commentator who served in the Reagan White House.
We've never seen the kind of reception for these groups that we're seeing in the Trump administration.
The idea that it's time to invite fewer people from around the globe to become permanent residents is based on the belief that there are simply too many unskilled immigrants and they are competing with low-skilled Americans for jobs. Economists have done studies for and against this theory, and each side fervently defends its case. Tamar Jacoby is head of Immigration Works USA, a pro-business group that wants more legal workers, not fewer, as the bill proposes.
It would be serious, serious changes to the dynamism of the American economy and the American spirit.
The arguments are not all economic. There's a cultural component to the notion that it's time to let the American melting pot cool down. In the House of Representatives, Republican Lamar Smith of Texas expects to propose a companion bill to reduce immigration. He's concerned about immigrant enclaves growing in metropolitan areas.
When you have so many immigrants being admitted, they tend to cluster together. They tend to maybe be a little bit more slow in learning the English language, to becoming acculturated, to becoming patriotic Americans.
Today's bill is the first in a series of GOP measures intended to redesign the American immigration system. Everyone agrees immigration desperately needs fixing. It remains to be seen if Congress is ready to narrow the gate. John Burnett, NPR News.
John Burnett's report first aired Tuesday on NPR's All Things Considered. American oil and gas companies like ExxonMobil, formerly led by new Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, are partnering with Pemex, Mexico's state-owned energy company. Mexico wants to modernize, financially stimulate, and clean up its energy industry. But as Marfa Public Radio's Lauren Madelon reports from Mexico City, reform has to take place at Pemex before more U.S. companies invest.
Pemex Tower is unmistakable on Mexico City's skyline. The nerve center of Mexican energy is a monument to oil and gas, when both produced massive, steady income. No longer. When Mexico ushered in energy reform 3 years ago, inviting foreign players into the market for the first time since 1938, crude oil sold for $100 a barrel. Today, it's news when it cracks 50. These days, Pemex is slashing its workforce and dumping pension obligations.
It's not easy to see a simple, competitive future for Pemex.
Mexican energy analyst David Shields.
Because it is overstaffed, it is overdebted, and it has all kinds of burdens that it has inherited over the years. When oil prices were high, and high prices bring inefficiency, overspending.
Pemex's finances are messy. Credit rating agency Moody's has issued a downgrade, and Fitch says Pemex faces insolvency. Pemex owns hospitals and hotels for offshore workers, things typically outsourced by major oil and gas companies.
You have to swallow very unsavory medicine in order to take care of the patient's illness.
Jorge Piñon's the former head of Amoco in Latin America. He now leads the Latin America Energy Program at the University of Texas at Austin. He says Pemex is taking its medicine, cutting the fat. But changing Pemex's corporate culture, he says, won't be quick or easy.
When you have an institution like Pemex that for 75 years has been a state monopoly, it is inherently corrupt in the way that it does business.
Just one example. A few weeks ago, a senior Mexican federal police official said some Pemex workers are almost certainly working with organized crime to steal oil. Pemex says the current gasoline shortage in Mexico, one that's sparking daily outrage, is in part caused by oil theft. Pemex admits corruption's a cancer.
It's a fact. We need to face it.
That's Jose Manuel Carrera, Pemex Director of Business Development. Across town, I met with Cleanto Lete, who heads the Mexico office of Brazil-based Braskem, Latin America's largest petrochemical company. Braskem's one of the early foreign players in the deregulated Mexican energy market. Lete says there's another problem at Pemex, brazen nepotism.
With somebody retired, he could indicate that he wanted his son or his nephew or somebody from his family to take his post. This is absurd.
He says that's changing, albeit slowly, and he agrees with former U.S. Ambassador to Mexico, Antonio Garza, who says U.S. energy companies will miss out if they don't move in. But Garza, who now lives in Mexico, also says some of those companies may not move until Pemex gets its books in order.
Does Pemex need to reform? I'd say, you bet. And most Mexicans would say, should have been done yesterday.
Pemex hasn't exactly been helped by the Mexican government. Instead of using profits to help the company upgrade equipment or train workers, it's used Pemex as a piggy bank, taking away its profits to build schools, hospitals, and in one case, a world-class baseball stadium.
We have laid out a clear set of mandates.
Pemex's Jose Manuel Carrera says despite those blights and low prices, there is an upside for U.S. energy companies, even if a Trump administration decides to make it more expensive for those companies to set up shop in Mexico.
The opportunity is so large that oil companies are discerning enough and understand the first barrels that will come out of these fields will be not now, but in 5 to 7 years. They should be actually looking at what is their price expectation on that horizon of time rather than actually just looking at the current price.
Mexico sees its energy reserves as a focal point of national pride. It's why foreign companies were kicked out in the first place almost 80 years ago. Reform wasn't an issue when oil prices were high, but now there's a real urgency to modernize Pemex and bring in foreign investment and expertise to rescue it. I'm Lorne Madelon in Mexico City.
Coming up on Fronteras, viewing the U.S.-Mexico border through the art of cinema at a film festival hosted in both countries.
We really tried to make this a lot broader and create a lot of different places for people to think about the border in ways, again, that transcend the politics that divide us right now.
We'll explore that story when we come back. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez. On the West Coast this week, a film festival viewed the debate over the U.S.-Mexico border through the art of cinema. And for the first time in 11 years, the Transborder Institute's annual film festival took place on both sides of the dividing line at the University of San Diego and in Tijuana, Mexico. Border Film Week showcased work from immigration to violence, human rights, and the environment. Maureen Cavanaugh of KPBS spoke with Ev Mead, executive director of USD's Transborder Institute, and Betsabe Garcia, producer and director of Los Reyes de Pueblo que No Existe, or Kings of Nowhere, winner of the 2016 South by Southwest Global Audience Award.
Now, Ev, Border Week is now in its 11th year. I'm curious if the more intense political debate over the border changed your approach to this year's event.
Yeah, I mean, I think this year we felt we had a special responsibility on the one hand to really make this much broader, to not just deal with the issues that people expect on the border and to look for phenomena that are bigger than the politics of the moment. So the ocean, water, human suffering, notions of beauty, a sense of place. We also thought we would try to blow up the genre a little bit. It's always been a documentary film festival, and it still is, but this year we have a classic film from the Mexican cinema from the 1940s. We've got an animated film. We have some feature films. We have some experimental films about migration. So we really tried to make this a lot broader and create a lot of different places for people to think about the border in ways, again, that transcend the politics that divide us right now.
Now, Betsabe, your feature-length documentary, Kings of Nowhere, is to about a rural town in Mexico that was submerged by a flood and three families who decided to stay behind. What appealed to you about this story?
Yes, well, I'm from Sinaloa, and this town is nearby Mazatlan, like 20 minutes driving. And I was living there for 5 years. This town was completely flooded by the construction of a dam, and three families are still living there. And there's a small tortillería machine making tortillas every morning, and they are trying to refix in the whole town by themselves. And it's a very intimate portrait of these three families and how they are still living there and fighting against the water.
And as you say, this town was submerged by the construction of a dam, which rerouted the waters and flooded the whole town. What do you think this film has to say to a San Diego audience?
I think it's a very important moment in Mexico, and we try to focus on what's happening in the mountains of Sinaloa. These towns are completely abandoned by the narco, and the a very important topic to talk about in Transborder Film Festival, and I'm very honored to be screening Kings of Nowhere.
Now, as you say, there's a classic 1940s film in this year's rundown. What is it about, and why did you choose to include it?
It's Maria Candelaria, which was Mexico's first submission to the Cannes Film Festival, and it was a winner in 1946. I really have the idea that, you know, we want to celebrate the cinema of the two countries, and one of the ways to do that is to bring in some classic films. And I paired it with Betsabe's film because of the theme of water, but also the theme of places that are forgotten. It tells the story of an indigenous community that's kind of forgotten. It's also, however, about the politics of a mob, about, you know, what happens when we listen to our emotions more than rational politics, and we punish people for their reputations more than their actual what they actually do. And that way, I think it dovetails very nicely with Betsabe's film, which is about a place, Sinaloa, which we all know really because of drug trafficking, you know, outside of Sinaloa. And people in Sinaloa have a lot more to tell us. And I think the film, you know, gives us, like she said, an intimate portrait of people who are just trying to hang on to the only place they've ever really known.
And this classic film, of course, with a Hollywood star, Dolores del Rio.
Absolutely. A star in Hollywood, a star in Mexico, a star for the whole world in the 1940s.
And the one film that speaks, I think, most clearly to the present controversy over immigration is a documentary called Mexican Dream. Tell us about that.
It's a wonderful film. It's by John Wetterall and Alex Reese. Alex is a UC San Diego alum, and we're really happy to show it because, on the one hand, it is about undocumented immigration in a particular rural town in Minnesota, but it's as much about how people talk about the issue as about the issue itself. It's mostly interviews, and it's ordinary, reasonable people who have very, very different opinions about it. And I think it's really important for people to come, listen to what they have to say, sort of take it in, And then afterwards, we're going to have a terrific public forum where we have some local experts, Tom Wong from UC San Diego, Pedro Rios from the American Friends Service Committee, and Eileen Truax, who's a journalist up in L.A., all of whom have written a lot about migration. They'll help us unpack the film and say, well, what can we do with these really disparate opinions of people who live right next door to each other and, in fact, depend on each other?
Now, Ev, this Border Film Week is going to Tijuana this year. Why was that important to take that event to Tijuana's?
I think it's really important because, first of all, our partner in Tijuana, Poland Audiovisual, has done a great job in helping us curate this festival for years, and we really wanted to kind of give them a showcase. But it's more than that. It's also about, you know, who's behind this film. And I think it's so important to signal that here at this moment when it seems like the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico is so uncertain and our rhetoric has become so harsh, that actually both governments are helping to sponsor a film festival together. You know, at a symbolic level, that's really, really important because it tells us again that, yeah, there are very serious questions that divide us along the border, but there's also a whole lot that we have in common, and there's a whole lot at stake in these questions. And it asks us to look at this in a more, perhaps a more thoughtful way.
That was Maureen Cavanaugh of KPBS with Ev Mead of the Transborder Institute and film director Betsabe Garcia. And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Shelley Koffler is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.